Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, one of the hosts of the channel. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm very pleased to say that we have Mariah Aden on the show today, and we'll be talking to her about her terrific book, The Brooklyn Thrill Kill Gang and the Great Comic Book Scare of the 1950s. As I was telling Mariah in the pre-interview, I encountered this case by reading a very old journal about 15 years ago, and I was thinking, this would make a fantastic book. I'm a lazy fellow, and I never got around to it. And in any case, I would not have done as good a job as Mariah did in this book. I very much encourage you to go out and buy it. And let me say to Mariah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a previous Fulbright scholar. I earned my PhD in American history at the University at Albany, where I worked with Dr. Richard Hamm. And currently, I'm the coordinator for the Pathways in Technology program at SUNY Orange and the assistant director for the C-STEP and AMP programs at SUNY New Paltz.
Wow, you're busy. In addition to writing books, you do all that.
And two toddlers.
Oh, my gosh. That's really like, yeah. They should have awards for those things. They just don't. I don't know why. I have three kids, too, and I can't understand why I don't get an award. I suppose a lot of people do it. But anyway, I was about to make a bad joke about wanting to kill your children.
You know what? I'll be honest with you. Until you have kids, you don't realize the amount of work that it is. And I will be honest that I come to the office for my break.
Oh, yeah. I know all about this. Tell me about it. Well, I hope that your kids and my kids don't end up like these fellows from Brooklyn in 1954. Your book is called Thrill Kill Gang. What was the Thrill Kill Gang and who was in it?
So the Thrill Kill Gang had four members. And the thing that's very interesting is, of course, you know, it gets publicized that they're this gang. And we hear the word gang and it has a lot of connotations. But as those who read the book will find out, you know, whether or not this word was actually apropos for this kind of conglomeration of four young men. It was four young men named Jack Coslow, who was kind of the ringleader of the group, Melvin Mittman, Bobby Robert Trachtenberg, and Jerome Lieberman.
And give us a little bit of biographical detail about these guys, because they do come from, as you say well in the book, they come from a very specific, and I would even say a kind of famous and storied context in you know, sort of the history of the United States of the second half of the century. Like, a lot of very famous people came out of this context.
Right. So, well, they're from Williamsburg, right, in the 1950s. And, you know, so essentially, you know, you have Jack Coslow is a pretty complicated young man, right? He was probably bisexual, you know, he had some problems at home, possibly an abusive father that was hinted at in his psychiatric interviews. You know, and he was also very brilliant. He had a very high IQ and a lot of promise. You know, so he had this very complicated background. He was friends with Melvin Mittman, who seemed to have a less complicated background, but perhaps had his own problems at home and his own issues. And then you had these two other young men, Bobby Trachtenberg and Jerome Lieberman, and they seemed to come from really, you know, good families. They're well spoken of typically throughout the neighborhood. So it's very interesting how, in some ways, how those two younger boys get mixed up with the two older ones. Mm-hmm. But they're all, you know, from this Williamsburg neighborhood, which is, at that time, it's this neighborhood in flux. It had been a spot where Jews from the Lower East Side had been coming into lower, you know, middle class and working class Jews had been coming into this neighborhood for a while at that point. And now we're leaving. And going out to greener climes, shall we say, out further east. And in the meantime, you had the start of this influx of Hasidic Jewry coming from Eastern Europe. And so it was a neighborhood in transition, and it was in transition in both that way, in terms of almost you know, just shifting ethnicity, but also it was in transition because the construction of the BQE which was ravishing this neighborhood because it was going right through the heart of it and decimating blocks. So it was definitely a neighborhood in transition. And I think in some ways, you know, that, that urban decay that's going to happen, is also aggravating the situation with these children.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess one of the things that, shocked me, actually, I found the book while at a, really good friend of mine's apartment. I was at his place on the Lower East Side, a place where I think he told his grandfather, he's Jewish, and he told his grandfather that he was moving to the Lower East Side, and he said, you know, we spent decades trying to get out of there, and you're moving back. I think the thing that struck me is that these are four nice Jewish boys whose parents had kind of made it. They did pretty well. They got all the way to Williamsburg. They haven't made it yet to Long Island, but they're going.
Yes. I mean, these were upwardly mobile families, right? You had the youngest boy in the group. His father owns a very prosperous electronics store. The older boy's Jack's father, the ringleader. His father owned a very successful garage, and he was a mechanic. That family actually was moving, and at the time that these crimes start happening, his family had just moved out further west. I'm sorry, further east. I think into the Flatbush area. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, these were very much like upwardly mobile. All the boys were kind of slated to go to college. They, some of them were actually at the very prestigious Boys Technical High School. These were young men who were definitely on this college bound upward mobility path. Before these crimes happened. And in fact, like ultimately, the two youngest boys, from what I could see out in the records of the world, I know Jerome Lieberman ultimately becomes an attorney, for example, so the two younger boys do ultimately end up, I think, on the path, to that upper middle class kind of lifestyle. But the older boys, who should have also been on that path, instead, I think that what ends up happening is their crimes, and what ends up happening in the story is going to kind of put them on a very different trajectory than what they should have been on.
Right. I mean, I'm sure everybody who listens to this has seen Rebel Without a Cause and probably has this image in their head of the high school tough with a tight T-shirt on and rolled up jeans and a cigarette pack and rolled up in the arm of their short sleeve white T-shirt. I don't think anybody associates nice Jewish boys from Williamsburg with that. So what exactly, how did these people, I mean, let's just put a name on it. How did they become juvenile delinquents, as they would have said?
Well, I think, and that's what's interesting. I mean, first of all, the statistics, the reason we don't think of it is that statistically, and even at that time, statistically, Jews were disproportionately less part of the juvenile delinquency scene than other ethnic groups, right? So it is true. I mean, part of the reason that we don't associate it necessarily with quote unquote good Jewish boys is because at that time, most Jews were not participating in this particular form of what's the word I'm looking for?
Rebellion? I don't know what to call it.
Right,
yeah,
I think rebellion is the word, right? So these boys were a little bit anomalous, like as far as that was concerned. I think it's difficult to say exactly entirely what set them off. For Coslow, in some ways, it's the easiest. And the book spends more time on Coslow than it does on the other boys. The reason why is because Coslow was interviewed by Dr. Frederick Wortham. And the notes of the psychiatric interview are available at the Library of Congress. And so because of that, it was a lot easier to get a perspective from Coslow himself, on why, how this sort of ended up happening. And in some ways, it's a kind of a classic story that happens even today, which is that Coslow was bullied. He was bullied substantially as a young child. And that eventually he just starts acting out. And he starts becoming, right? It just gets to a point where then he's going to start becoming the bully. And it starts out in a variety of ways. I mean, he does act out a little bit in elementary school. He was certainly a rabble-rouser. He also had a longtime fascination with the Nazis, which is very incongruous, right, for a young Jewish boy to have.
Put it mildly.
Right. But, you know, but at the same time, you know, when you're reading the psychiatric interview, it actually makes a substantial amount of sense. You know, to him as a young child who felt very powerless, both at home and at school, and in his neighborhood, actually, in particular, you know, the Nazis, and hearing about this powerful military, right, that was taking over Europe, and hearing about this on the radio, you know, and he felt, he identified in some ways, with this group, right, which he felt, which to him was like this, almost like this powerful underdog.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how he saw himself. And ultimately, when it came to committing the crimes, it's certainly how he saw himself. He understood himself as a superhero. He was beating these people up. I think at one point, you know, one of the younger boys tells the police that the older boys had said, you know, we got these bums. It was something like, we got these bums, and, you know, we tried to teach them to stop drinking and clean up their lives, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think he really believed this. Like, he saw this, like, as he was acting in this sort of Good Samaritan kind of way, that he's going out, he's cleaning up the streets. Right, he's kind of being this superhero, and part of that, of course, is highlighted by his use of, you know, he would wear this vampire costume, right? Because he very much associated himself with these very specific comic book characters, and he would, you know, don these outfits as part of, you know, this ritual before going out and and causing these assaults. So, you know, so they were very, he was very selective in his victims. And he also, you know, had this very interesting sense of righteousness, right? Where he, you know, but like he brags about the fact that, you know, but he never stole, right? I never pickpocketed, I never stole. That's beneath me.
Uh-huh.
That's not what this is about. This is about being a vigilante. And so I think like it's kind of this almost classic story of this, you know, young bullied man who's trying to find, you know, some kind of power and masculinity, you know, through this kind of what he sees as this vigilante justice kind of scenario.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the comic book connection. What are the kinds of comic books that he was reading? And I don't think they're very old at this point, are they? Remind me, I don't know. So if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Oh, the comic books or the boys?
Comic books.
No, the comic books are not very old. I mean, well, this time period, right, you know, comic books had shifted. And, you know, you start going from this, you know, this more superhero style comic books, and you had the Donald Duck comic books and all those. I think those are kind of, in some ways, the classic ones that people think of. And then suddenly in this period, in the, you know, post-war, you start seeing this turn to crime comics first, which were increasingly brutal in nature and very graphic. And then we go from crime comics, and that kind of dies down, and then you start having this rise of romance comics. And then at this moment, when you have the Brooklyn Thrill Kill Gang, the market is being dominated by horror comics. And the issue with horror comics is that, you know, they're increasingly brutal. You know, I mean, there's scenes in there, you know, like of people having their limbs eaten off by rats. I mean, there's, you know, people, there's a lot of, for some interesting reason, eyeball torture.
Eyeballs,
and I'm sure
eyeballs.
Somebody could write a whole book about that.
Yeah, uh-huh. Eyeballs.
Eyeballs. I mean, I guess that's, you know, but there was just all sorts of different and inventive, forms of torturing other people. And, you know, and part of it is that this was, I think David Haidu describes it as a spiral of gruesomeness, where each cover and each comic book tries to outdo the next, right? Because they're competing for readers. And so it's like, well, as disgusting as, you know, that comic was last month, we could be more disgusting, we could be more violent, we could be more graphic. So, you know, so this is kind of the genre that's really happening at that moment. And that's, you know, so he really identifies with these vampire and horror comics. He also has a collection, and this is the one that ends up being kind of the big thing ultimately for the, as far as New York State law is concerned, with these pornographic comics. And they're called Knights of Horror. And there's actually a great book out there by Craig Yeoh that's just about Joe Shuster, who was co-creator of Superman, who did the artwork for these comics. You know, so these are extremely, extremely violent, pornographic, you know, sadistic comic books. And, of course, Jack has the whole collection of these. And to be honest, he does model his crimes very much after what he's seeing in these comic books. So, you know, they'll go after young women in parks and they whip them, and he actually admits, you know, yes, I got that right from the comic books.
Mm-hmm.
Having people kiss his feet, there's a variety of the cigarette torture that he engages in with some of the victims. So a lot of these are coming, and he very readily admits that these things are inspired by what he's seen in the comic books.
I mean, it's so interesting because my son and daughter are kind of into comic books, and I can walk a few blocks from my house to a comic book store that is, I think it's next to an Ann Taylor. And we can buy all that stuff and more. So at this time, though, there were still obscenity laws, weren't there? Had these comic books come to the attention of the authorities?
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, well, the problem is that, you know, at this time, you know, America was in a very different place. And a lot of it, people were not thrilled about obscenity laws. And I think we have kind of this mischaracterization of the 1950s as an era when everybody just wants to legislate things. But the reality is that, you know, people really were advocating for self-regulation. So, you know, even though there is the Hollywood production code, for example, right? And so Hollywood had been regulated at that point for a couple of decades, but television had not been. And no one was going after television because television self-regulated. They created their own code that was kind of modeled after the Hollywood production code. And they also, their advertisers, frankly, served to a great extent as a form of self-censorship, right? I mean, advertisers just didn't want to be associated with things that were too controversial
sure.
or too anything. So that also, you know, just kind of censored itself. So comic books become problematic primarily because they had made no effort to create an adult audience. And so it becomes increasingly difficult for you to argue that you should have full freedom of the press and that you should have the ability to publish whatever that you want and as gruesomely as you want to publish when your audience is only children.
Mm-hmm.
So there had been at this point, at the time that the thrill killers are happening, there had been over a decade of attempts to try to cajole the industry into self-regulating. And it kept failing. And it kept failing partially of the fault of the industry and partially not its fault. The problem with comic books, unlike something like television, is that they could be cheaply made
right.
in somebody's basement.
Right.
And in fact, those pornographic comics that Jack Caswell had were being cheaply made in some mafia guy's basement, right? So, so there is that issue where it becomes very difficult because you do have these big major publishers like Dell, for example, who is, you know, well, Dell made very wholesome comics. So they were all about regulation. They're like, it does nothing but help us, you know, because they want parents to trust them. Their sales actually increase the more trust that parents have in comic books, right? So there were these large companies that were very much for it. But then there are these much smaller operations, these much more fly-by-night operations, and they weren't interested in regulation. They want to sell. They want to sell quickly. Mm-hmm. So you have that issue, right? So you have the issue that you can't get people on board. And the very first time that the comic books try to self-regulate, that's pretty much what happens. I mean, it's you only get a certain percentage of the groups to sign up, and the people who were creating the most gruesome. And this is the first attempt was really focused on the crime comics, and the companies that were making the most egregious comics, they just simply wouldn't sign up and they wouldn't self-regulate. So by the time you have William Gaines and, trying to organize and getting the second round of, in 1954, you start seeing this real push because they really are seeing the writing on the wall. We've reached a point where parents and legislatures are getting very upset. The U.S. Senate Subcommittee hearings on juvenile delinquency had at that point started focusing on comic books in March of 1954. So you have this showdown that happens, right? And it's televised between William Gaines and Frederick Wortham. And, so now it's really of national prominence. And so the comic book publishers are like, wow, okay, the writing's on the wall here. We need to regulate. We need to make this happen. And so they actually do, you know, create a comic czar position. They're trying at that point desperately to try to get this, you know, these comic books have to go through the czar. They have to be, you know, approved. You know, so they're trying to clean up at that point, but it's really too little too late. And it's been a whole decade at that point of just a lack of self-regulation. So, you know, so there's no, the comic books aren't falling under obscenity laws. They have to, they're going to end up ultimately creating laws that are going to ban very specific, specific titles, they're going to ban crime, ban horror, you know, and it just goes this whole complex legislation that happens in New York State, of this list of things that you can no longer do. And that's going to completely decimate the industry. But it's also after about a decade of trying to get the industry to self-regulate.
Hmm. Comic books are, I don't know what to say about that. So then I guess the timing of the Thrill Kill Gang was not terribly good because they commit their crimes, or their crimes come to light in, I guess you say the summer of 1954?
Yep, August. Yep.
Yeah, so you've already mentioned this a little bit. Could you talk a little bit about what they did specifically and a little bit about why they did it? You talked about that as well, but if you just reiterate.
So, I mean, so what they did is, I guess it's important to kind of parse it out a little bit. The two older boys were mainly the ones who did everything, right? And then the two younger boys get wrapped up, unfortunately, in the two major crimes, the two dates that somebody actually gets killed. There's two dates where people die. And unfortunately, the younger boys were present at both those dates. And that's how they end up really getting wrapped into it. But the two older boys, in particular, had gone around. They had whipped some people. So young women, they would find young women in parks at night if they, you know, felt there's a young woman out too late. And they would whip them with horse whips.
Yeah.
So there's a very sexual aspect, especially those crimes. They often, especially the one boy, Mel, would grope their breasts, and somewhat, you know, so they wouldn't, it's not, they wouldn't rape them, but there was sexual assault, certainly involved in it. So there's that aspect. They would go after vagrants. Either vagrants or people who were drunk. They found like a drunk sleeping, on a bench. And they would beat them up pretty much. They would, burn them with cigarettes, and beat them up. So that's pretty much, what they were doing. So they were going around kind of terrorizing those populations, that summer.
Mm-hmm.
So there was two instances where, people ended up dying. In both cases, accidentally. It was not their intent actually to kill anyone, believe it or not, even though their name was the Brooklyn Thrill Kill Gang, right? They did not actually intend to kill anyone. The one man died after he was hit. His head fell and hit one of the grates in the sidewalk and the storm drain, and it fractured his skull.
Mm-hmm.
And the other man ended up drowning in the river. So they did, the two deaths actually were accidental. They certainly were out to assault people.
Mm-hmm. And then the notion is, they didn't leave any manifesto or anything, but the notion is that they're, at least on the part of the two older boys, they're going to clean the city up. Or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, I mean, yeah, there's certainly no manifesto. I mean, it's interesting because I'm not entirely sure what Mel believed, right? So the one boy, I mean, I think maybe was just out to beat people up. I mean, I'm not really sure. But the older boy, I mean, I think, in his own way, like he kind of felt like he had this kind of vigilante thing going on. But at the same time, he also admits that he did it because it was thrilling and he wanted to feel powerful. One of the things I think that made the older boy very interesting, Jack, is because, you know, I think maybe because he was very intelligent, he had he had a real self-awareness in his own way about what he was doing and a self-consciousness about what he was doing, and why, you know, And it's very interesting because in his interview with Wortham, like he really kind of puts it out there, you know, and he will admit that he wanted to feel powerful. He wanted to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not completely delusional in thinking that it's just about being a vigilante. But, you know, but then there's also, yeah, the part of him is like, it is a little bit about being a vigilante. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So, where did they do this? And you already mentioned women, but did they have particular targets? You mentioned people that were, you know, street people, or I don't know what you want to call homeless people. Did they pick, I mean, was it more specific than that?
You know, I think that primarily, I think fundamentally they were just looking for easy targets. I think that's fundamentally what they were doing. But, I mean, certainly, like, you know, Jack expressed disgust at the people who drank. He found that very disgusting and distasteful, mm-hmm. And he expressed that very clearly in his interviews with the police. You know, so I think like that was his, you know, one of his main things. Like it tended to be vagrants, but it mostly really tended to be people who were passed out drunk.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that would get his ire up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where did all this occur? Where was their stomping grounds, so to say?
You know, it was, there's this place called Triangle Park, right? So it's right near, it's like this real scrap of land that's happening near the bridge. So they would go there. They also liked going to, like some of the other parks in the area. You know, basically, I mean, mm-hmm. my understanding is they would go, and also, because this place is right now, it was in that moment of being devastated. So, you know, I know on like a Rodney Street, there was, you know, these abandoned housing that was about to be torn down to build the BQE. You know, so a lot of times vagrants were congregating in those areas,
mm-hmm.
You know, kind of squatting mm-hmm. until the buildings were torn down. And so those tended to be the places they would go. I know McCarran Park is where they tended to go after young women because that was a place where young women were going to be hanging out, especially after hours. So it was just all throughout the Williamsburg area. They mm-hmm. would kind of just like, you know, just troll around trying to find victims.
Right. I mean, did Jack's parents ever ask him, why are you dressed like a vampire and why do you keep going out late at night?
Not that we could tell. The vampire, the thing with the vampire costume, I guess I should clarify. I mean, he wasn't in a full-on Halloween vampire costume. For him, his costume, it was this pair of black leather pants. I think it was like a black turtleneck. It was almost like very beatnik-like, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for all we know, his parents just thought he was going to a poetry reading. I don't know. You know, so it may not have been as obvious, I guess, is what I'm saying. But to him, this was a vampire costume. This was mm-hmm. his interpretation of that kind of look. And, you know, like, and he had, like, I think a black overcoat with it or something. You know, but yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, his parents, yeah, they never really asked, like, why are you dressed mm-hmm. like that or why are you going out?
As long as you get good grades.
Well, that's the thing. Now, Jack was having problems at that point.
Oh, really?
And that's also part of the thing, the reason that the crimes, right, start happening, because in his life, everything had kind of gone to hell in a handbasket mm-hmm. a little bit. He graduated quite early, from high school. From boys' high school, actually, which was a very good high school in Brooklyn at the time. And he had graduated early, and he was going to NYU. And he just, you know, it just started falling apart for him at that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was also suffering most likely from mental illness.
Yeah.
I mean, he was diagnosed by multiple doctors as having dementia praecox. You know, so he was really at this age where all this was really happening. But yeah, he ends up flunking out of NYU.
Uh-huh.
And so now he has to find a job, and he's not having a lot of success holding on to a job. So, you know, so this is, you know, part of the problem, right? Is
right.
that his whole life is sort of kind of falling apart at this moment.
Right.
When he starts acting out.
Mm-hmm. Right. So how do these crimes come to the attention of the authorities? And when? I guess what I'm asking is, was there a moment at which that Jack knew that he was being pursued, that the police were sort of on his tail?
No. You know, it's interesting how it happens. I mean, you know, the police had, I think, you know, one of the interesting parts about this crime is that I think so much of what ends up happening with this case is because of its timing, right? Because you were in this moment where people really cared about juvenile delinquency and they really cared about, you know, about comic books, particularly juvenile delinquency, right? I mean, you have the Senate subcommittee hearings. You have, as I go through in the book, I have a whole chapter that's just about, you know, the 10,000 things that they were happening in New York City. And every other week there was like, right, there was a speech, there was something about juvenile. People were just, you know, really freaking out about, juvenile delinquency at this moment. So, you know, because I think fundamentally the assaults on a handful of, vagrants just wouldn't really be a focus for the police.
Right. That's what I was thinking.
There's just no nice way to say that, right?
Yep.
I mean, and so, I mean, it's not something that would have really just been on their radar, except that, you know, right now was a moment when the police were already taking a lot of heat for this, you know, this idea that the kids were out of control. And, of course, the homeless people are reporting that it's these, you know, teenagers that are beating them up. And so what ends up happening, so there's really no point. I mean, I think Jack really thinks that he's flying, you know, under the radar. And in fact, his arrest, you know, really happens, you know, it's quite coincidentally. I mean, well, they actually beat up some people right near a police station, as a matter of fact. I mean, that's how bold, like, you know, him and Mel had gotten. And it was the same night that that they killed Willard Mentor. So, you know, after they killed Willard Mentor, they go out and they beat somebody else up. And it's in the park that's right across the street. Louis Sobel Park, and it's right near the precinct, and that's it. And they're outside having a cigarette, like practically in front of the precinct.
And the cops just like come nab them.
Yes. The detective basically comes out. No, he comes out and he sees two vagrants standing there, who seem kind of upset, and he asks them what's going on. And they're saying that somebody got beat up in the park, and he had already heard, like, from, you know, they already kind of had it out there that they were looking for a couple teenagers, one of whom was a redhead, right? And that was also part of it, too, because Jack Hoslow was a redhead. And, you know, that they were looking for a couple teenagers. And so now you have these guys, and they're standing there saying that somebody had just gotten beaten up in the park. And he just looked across the street and saw, like, this redheaded kid and this other kid sitting there. And he was like, all right.
Yeah.
So I guess that's it. And he literally walked across the street and arrested them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they had just become that level of emboldened. So I don't think that Jack, I think in some ways Jack thought he was, I don't know, I hate to say it, but I think he felt he was so clever, perhaps, that like he was just not going to get caught and that he could be so bold as to assault someone in front of the police station.
So what does Jack say when he's arrested? Does he lawyer up or does he confess or what's he do?
Well, they end up confessing. I mean, this is, you know, a time period, and that's an interesting part of the story, too, is how these kids get railroaded. You know, so, again, the police and district attorney are under a lot of pressure at this moment, again, about juvenile delinquency. It's on everybody's mind. And so, and also, of course, you know, the newspapers had already been filled. There had just been a stomp killing. Right. Where this war hero, I mean, this guy comes home and he just survived like the war and he's now has a nice, you know, as a businessman and he has like, you know, a bunch of kids and he's just living this great middle class American life. And he's walking home from work and this teenager gets annoyed about him whistling and literally stomps him to death. Right. And so, I mean, this had just happened like probably about a month earlier. So, I mean, people were really already just like in Brooklyn, just like freaking out at this moment. Okay. Now that kid came from a divorced family, right? His dad was out of the picture. The kid was drinking at the time of the assault. You know, he had a long record of being a problem child, you know, so in some ways, at least like he fell into a nice neat category. But you know, these boys didn't, you know, these boys were upwardly mobile, you know,
right,
as we talked about earlier. So, you know, so I think like, you know, so there's all this. And so, people are going to freak out about this case. And so because of that, the district attorney's office and the police are going to kind of railroad these kids. And so they don't lawyer up at this point in time, right? We don't have Miranda yet. Okay. Miranda's not for another good decade. So there's no Miranda. There's no right to an attorney, necessarily for questioning. And they actually do like some crazy publicity stunts where they take the boys down to the docks when they dredge up the body. They have them point to the body. They have the press take pictures. They have, the district attorney take statements from these boys standing in front of the body, at the docks, right? With no lawyers. I mean, that's the thing. You look at this, there's not a lawyer present, right? And at that point, I think they actually even had lawyers. But they didn't even notify the lawyers. So there's so much happening. And at this point, all of this is legal, right? This is all, I mean, it's distasteful, and we can certainly see it today as injustice. But at this point, it's technically not illegal to do. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole like kind of publicity aspect. Like the boys are actually, because the Sam Shepard case, right, which is going to kind of really be the thing that kind of curtails press in the courtroom and the kind of shenanigans the police can do with the press, right? That's happening contemporaneously to this case, right? Mm-hmm. So that ruling hasn't been made yet, okay? So basically, these boys, like there's pictures of them, and you actually see in the book, a lot of the pictures, I think, are actually coming from the police station, right? So, they have the boys sitting there, and they, bring in cameramen. They allow the press access, and they take pictures of the boys sitting at the police station, and they take pictures of the boys. There's actually one in the book where Eddie Walsh, one of the people that, the boys had beaten up, is actually sitting there pointing a finger right at Jack Coslow, mm-hmm. In the police station. So it's this really damning kind of evidence that's going to happen and play out in the press. Mm-hmm. Right, which is going to make it very difficult to create an impartial jury and a fair trial.
Right, and it becomes national news almost instantly.
Yes.
Everybody reads about this case.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's all the way to Los Angeles to actually even Australia. I think they even had articles in Australia and in other countries about it. So, yeah, it's very quickly becomes a national sensation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I guess one question I have is, do you know how their parents reacted?
Wow. Well, their parents, I mean, of course, are devastated. Mm. And I think for the most part, I don't think their parents quite believe it, mm-hmm. Certainly the parents of the younger boys, and particularly, like, I think we get a lot from of statements from Jerome Lieberman's father, who talks very readily to the press. Because I think he's just blown away, right? I mean, his son, and again, Jerome Lieberman, of the four of them, is the one where, nobody has a bad word to say about this kid, mm-hmm. right? I mean, all the old ladies in the neighborhood adore him, everybody, he's just, and he kind of gets wrapped up in this because he's best friends with Bobby. Bobby becomes friends with Mel, and Mel's friends with Jack, you see? So he kind of gets roped into this mess. And he does. I mean, certainly at the one instance, he actually, he slaps the one guy and he does participate a little bit. But his father is very vocal to the press, and it's just like, this can't be. My kid could not have done these things. Like, mm-hmm. he's not that kid. And, certainly I think for the most part, the parents are very shocked. And I don't think any of them, including Jack's parents, I think even for all of Jack's problems, I don't think that even Jack's parents suspected that he was doing anything like this.
Right, right. So what does the, district attorney charge them with?
Well, that's right. So that goes back to, this becoming a big national case and being in the press and the kind of the gestalt at the moment, concerning juvenile delinquency. So they get charged with murder one. Mm. They're doing a murder one charge based on a felony kidnapping. So the idea being that in the walk that they made Willard Mentor walk with them from Triangle Park to the pier, and that was a walk of multiple blocks, mm-hmm. and that walk was in fact kidnapping. Mm-hmm. The reality is that it's a trumped up charge. Right. I mean, certainly, no one would condone what these kids did, and I certainly would not argue that they shouldn't have gone to jail. But what they did was an assault charge, and at best a man won. They did accidentally kill someone. But there was no point that this was a murder charge.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's in the press, because it's getting the attention it's getting, you can't charge them with anything less.
Right.
And so they're actually facing the death penalty.
Right.
And that's one of the things that's a big deal about this case as well, is that you have these four boys, ranging in age from, 15 to 18 years old, now facing the death penalty.
Right. But a question that occurs to me is, how is it that we know that they didn't intend to kill these individuals except by their own testimony? That is, they tell us that they didn't, but is there any other corroborating evidence that shows that they didn't intend to kill these two people? You would expect them to say, obviously we didn't want to kill them and they just died.
Well, I think because of how both men died,
mm-hmm.
I think to me that also, that's part of it. And also the fact that, the two men who died, and they actually only charged in the murder of one.
Uh-huh.
The other one was a manslaughter charge. And the other one, actually, Jack Oslo wasn't even involved in. It was just
Mel.
The two younger boys. In the case of Willard Mentor, I mean, they beat him up, and then they threw him into the river. And I'm not sure that they would know whether or not someone knew how to swim. And then that's really what happened. I mean, the man died because he didn't know how to swim.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I feel like if they really wanted to kill someone,
then you would just beat them
until they died. I mean, or you'd do something, I think, probably, I would imagine, more hands-on. But, you're right. I mean, it could be there is no proof other than their own statements.
Right.
But I do think because of, for better or for worse, their blatant honesty. If you really look at, the confessions and
mm-hmm.
Their own statements, I mean, they're very honest about, what they did and why they did it.
But
I
was going to say, they don't, you guys see this on TV a lot. I don't know if it actually happens. And also it occurs in the famous prisoner's dilemma. Do they try to shift the blame to other people in the group, or do they all kind of agree I did this and he did that and he did this and he did that? You see what I'm saying?
Well, I would say that there is some shifting of blame in that everyone ends up jumping on Jack Oslo.
Mm-hmm.
Although Jack Oslo also fairly readily admits that he's the ringleader. You do see, everyone admits, for the most part to their part of having beaten people up or not, what they did as far as that stuff's concerned. The big issue becomes between Jack and Mel as to who pushed the guy in the water,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they're trying to, say that that's right. So that's the actual murderous act, is the pushing of, mm-hmm. of the man into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And Mel's going to say it was Jack. And I think, I don't know if, does Jack say it was Mel or not? I think Jack says the guy just fell in,
mm-hmm.
Nobody pushed him. He just sort of jumped himself, mm-hmm. tried to get away from them and tripped off the pier. But, there's a little bit of shifting of blame as far as just that one final act. The rest of it, I think, for the most part, the two younger boys, certainly, they're very much like, listen, it was the older guys who did this, and we really didn't have much to do with it. And certainly in the case of Jerry Lieberman, by all accounts, it sounds like he really didn't have much to do with anything. Bobby, it's a little bit more, questionable. And in fact, he does end up in a juvenile detention center for the full length of as long as they could put him in there,
mm-hmm.
So until the age of 21, because his parole officer doesn't feel that he has adequate amounts of remorse for his participation in the crimes.
I see.
But, yeah.
So what it sounds like a thankless and impossible task, but what kind of defense did their attorneys mount?
Ooh. Well, I have to say, when I was writing this, okay, it was such an interesting and amazing project to work on, because it starts out being interesting, and then it gets more interesting.
Yeah, I'm
and
telling
then it
you
just
what.
Gets surreal, right? And then it gets, and then, so as soon as you ask this question, you're like, what do the attorneys do? And that's when it just gets crazy, right? This is the moment when you're like, this could be a movie, and
yeah.
no one will believe it. So you have different levels of defense attorneys, and the two younger boys end up with extremely venerable, right, defense attorneys. But you end up with Jack Coslow, okay? And he ends up with this, oh my goodness, why am I blanking on the guy's name?
Let's call him Jack Coslow's attorney.
Jack Coslow's attorney, okay. So Jack Coslow's attorney. Well, okay, so basically, so the two younger boys, they end up with these very venerable attorneys, right? So you end up with people like James D.C. Murray, okay, who had done tons of homicide trials, and he was just this really famous and very well-known defense attorney at the time. And then Bobby also gets a very venerable defense attorney, someone who had actually done, in fact, they had done work with another juvenile who had been charged with facing first-degree murder. So, you know, so they have this a very different level of attorney. But Jack's attorney, Morritt, Fred Morritt, is a little bit different. He has a sideline. Well, he was actually really well known for being a singer, and an entertainer, and he had had his own radio show. And
sounds like he could run for president. That was a joke.
Right. Right. I mean, well, no, he was a politician, actually.
There you go.
A politician. He represented Brooklyn in the state Senate. He was a politician. He was a singer. He had actually written an operetta, and he had actually written some music that had was used in movies, as a matter of fact. So, you know, he was just very
a Renaissance man.
Kind of a Renaissance man, absolutely. But unfortunately, he was a really good showman, okay, and a really crappy attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And So his defense, the closing arguments, for example, where he just does a paraphrase of 10 Little Indians, so that was just mind blowing. He just does a bunch of theatrics, right? And he actually tries doing this defense where he's trying to, use the stenographer. And try to prove that the stenographer did not take adequate, or that the stenography notes were fudged from the interviews, which is probably true, actually. I mean, and on this one, it's probably true. I mean, he could not get a hold of the person from the newspaper, but certainly we know at least one newspaper reporter reported who was at the docks, right, when they were doing these ridiculous interviews in front of the corpse. One of the newspaper reporters actually, had reported that Jack saying, I didn't push him in. I didn't do it. He fell in. I didn't push him. Or I tried to save him or something along those lines, which, of course, is not in the stenographer's official statement. So Morritt, in fact, wasn't wrong. The problem with Morritt is just that he was so theatrical that it just alienated everyone in the courtroom, including the jury. So that was ultimately the problem. However, and it's also interesting that he chose ultimately not to do a psychiatric defense. They hired Dr. Frederick Wortham, who is probably mm-hmm. one of the most preeminent, criminologists of the era, as well as being an anti-comics crusader. But he really was a formidable criminologist. He interviewed Jack. He was ready to go. He was just waiting to be called to give his testimony, and they basically called and said, "We don't need you." So they chose not to do a psychiatric defense. But I think the main reason why is because for all his theatrics and all the shenanigans, right, I think maybe Morritt was a sly fox, and he knew that they were going to win on appeal, which mm-hmm. they did.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had a very appealable issue, and in fact, the prosecution handed it to them in a bow. And it's very interesting because it was done so quietly.
And what is the issue?
The issue was whether or not it was felony kidnapping.
Right.
And it's very difficult to say, so the prosecution puts up a witness, right? They put up a police officer who basically is going to testify that there's on this walk between the park and the pier, there's people going in and out of these steakhouses. There's people going in and out of gas stations. There's all this nightlife. There's, all the whole bunch of different call boxes, police call boxes mm-hmm. along the way. You know, so there was ample opportunity, in theory, for the victim to have called out for help, you know, to say, hey, I'm being kidnapped, to have run away and run into, you know, a crowded area. So this wasn't exactly a deserted walk,
right?
That there was substantial nightlife. And the appellate court's going to agree and say that's a pretty loose basis for kidnapping. And so because of that, the murder one charge falls.
Mm-hmm.
And the boys ultimately go to jail for manslaughter.
Mm-hmm. So so two of them are juveniles, right?
Yes.
Yes. And are they tried with the other two?
They are, because that's the loophole. So they're juveniles, and in the New York court system at the time, you're a juvenile with the exception of murder charges.
Oh.
And so basically because of the charge of conspiracy kidnapping, and that was a murder one, they're allowed to be tried as adults.
Right, I see. So what sentences were handed down to them?
Well, ultimately, Mel and Jack are going to get manslaughter charges.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to go to jail, I think, for less than 10 years each.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby ends up in juvenile detention center until the age of 21. Jerome actually has the case against him dismissed. And he actually ends up having both cases against him dismissed.
Huh.
You know, and rightfully. I mean, the reality is that although he was present, you know, in neither case did he actually do anything. And the entire case against him was about the conspiracy, that he was part of the conspiracy to kidnap and do these crimes, but not because he actually participated. So in the end, he ends up, the charges in both cases end up being dismissed.
Mm-hmm, I see. So just to close the circle, if you know, what happened to the four of them?
Well, let's see. I know Mel Mittman, as far as I know, he did his time in jail, and he ended up in Florida. I believe he got married and had kids.
Mm-hmm.
Lived a fairly unremarkable life. I think Jack also served his time, ended up eventually married with a child, also fairly unremarkable life. I believe Jerome Lieberman became an attorney. I know that he was graduating from college and heading to law school when the second charges got dismissed against him in the Ulrichsen case. So I think that's where he ended up. I'm not sure what happened with Robert Trachtenberg.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But I think they went on to lead, fairly normal, unremarkable lives.
Yeah. What was the consequence of the trial and the sentences for the comic book industry?
Well, that's another, right. So that's the other side of it. So what ends up happening is, so again, there had been a substantial amount of anger going on against the comic book industry for quite some time and their lack of ability to clean themselves up. So we end up with a situation where, the New York State legislature creates its own subcommittee, right, to study the comics and comic books. Okay. And it's run by a man named James A. Fitzpatrick. And Fitzpatrick had long been an anti-comics kind of crusader. To be honest, actually, he didn't start out that way. I mean, he had his issues with comic books. He's very Catholic. At that time in the early 40s, the Catholic Church had been coming down against comic books. They were concerned with including things like Superman, which they felt were too Nietzschean in a lot of ways. So the Catholic Church had long kind of had its own issues with comic books. And so Fitzpatrick, was not thrilled with comic books, but he had long advocated for them to clean themselves up, right? But I think he got very upset after the first attempt that he was involved in to clean up comics, okay? Basically that it just failed miserably, right? And I think that, after that, he just became very soured to the industry. And so he sponsored what was called the Feinberg-Fitzpatrick Bill. Initially they wanted to try to create this comic book division in the State Department of Education, right, to kind of regulate comic books. And that fails because everyone's like, we don't want to spend that kind of money. And again, you know, the push was they should clean themselves up. We don't want government regulation. Because we always think the 50s, everyone jumps to that, but they don't. They really don't. They want them to self-regulate. So by the time we get to 1954, he's like just had enough of it. And so they have this, this meeting, right? And they bring in the new comic czar, okay, by the name of Charles Murphy. And, you know, so it's kind of like this big moment. He comes in with all his evidence. He's like, look how we're cleaning up comics and whatever. But the reality is that Fitzpatrick had been in correspondence with Frederick Wortham. And Fitzpatrick at this point was already sick of the industry. And he was sick of the years and years of asking them to clean up and kind of being rebuffed by them. So at this point, he just kind of, you know, then just puts Wortham on the stand and says, what do you think? And Wortham just decimates. Right, Charles Murphy's testimony. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because he goes through and he says, well, yeah, right, you're saying that you cleaned up these advertisements, for example, in the back, but here's, you know, I just found these, you know, these things that you're saying are out, they're still in, mm-hmm. Et cetera. And Wortham, because of his involvement with the Thrill Kill case, right, and he had done these interviews with Jack Coslow, so that's what he testifies to. And of course, again, you know, there were these horribly egregious comic books, The Knights of Horror, that Jack had been reading, that a lot of crimes were based on, and so Wortham brings that right in. And of course, you know, and in Charles Murphy's defense, I mean, those comics would never have gone through his authority, right? Because they're pornographic comics being published by some underground guy, and certainly no one's going to submit them for a stamp of approval, mm-hmm. right? But the reality is that they're still out there, and Wortham, of course, and Fitzpatrick are going to jump on the Brooklyn Thrill Killers and on Jack Coslow in particular to say, like, you know, this shows, right? Like, here's this kid, this messed up kid who already had problems, and he's going to go out and commit crimes based on these comic books that were just a bad influence and gave him awful ideas on things to do. Mm-hmm. And that was Wortham's position for years, right? Wortham had always advocated, you know, and I think that that's kind of a mistake that people have about Frederick Wortham, where they're like, oh, he's, you know, saying that just normal kid's going to read a comic book and go crazy. You know, I mean, Wortham was a sophisticated criminologist, you know, but what he was advocating was that if you have a messed up kid, you know, left to their own imagination, messed up kids act out in very, fairly specific kind of ways. You know, I mean, they're going to beat people up, or they're going to steal, or they're going to do the normal, you know, kind of delinquency things. But, you know, his fear is that, you know, you're handing these kids these very gruesome comic books that are all about just torturing human beings and et cetera. And you're handing this to a messed up child. And now this child has all sorts of fantastic ideas on how to act out. That they would not have per se come up with on their own. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he's necessarily wrong about that.
Right.
So what ends up happening because of all this is the New York State Legislature is going to adopt a law that is going to essentially ban crime and horror comics. And they're going to cite the Brooklyn Thrill Killers, you know, as one of the main pieces of evidence to show why this law is necessary and, you know, and the ill effects that comic books have, on children and on the delinquent mind, essentially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's very interesting. People today are at loggerheads about what video games do. I know that my son and daughter really like video games. They really like them. People argue all the time about whether they're a good effect or a bad effect. I don't know what to think. I don't know. Of course, then again, my son does not dress up in a vampire cape and go around beating vagrants up. At least I don't think. I'm pretty sure he doesn't do that.
But that's, I mean, you know, what? But one of the issues is that, you know, and I think it's interesting because we actually do have, I mean, you know, it's an interesting issue in America. And I think to me, like, what's changed is our sense of community has changed, right, more than the evidence. And I think the evidence has always suggested, and including now the studies, I think, show very clearly that, you know, violent video games mass media materials, you know, desensitize children, mm-hmm. that they actually do cause adrenaline fluctuations. Uh-huh. That, you know, that there is a long list of effects, actually, that we really know scientifically. We've actually measured scientifically, right? We've been able to, you know, just even measure pulse rates and measure adrenal spikes and all sorts of stuff. So, you know, there is that reality, right? And I think, like, you know, one of the things I would say is that in the, you know, in the 1950s, what's different is that we happen to be in a period of America. And, of course, I have to caveat this and say, right, and, of course, this doesn't apply to everyone, right, because we all know with segregation and sexism and everything.
Sure.
But overall, America had this idea of a certain sense of community, right? And so there was this absolutely this idea that, you know, if these books, if these things are bad for children, right, even if it's not necessarily bad for you, even if you have a normal child or you have a fine child and it won't affect your child, the idea that it could harm other children, right, is enough for you to say, then as a society, we're going to choose to forgo it, right? Either it has to be regulated or something has to happen here. And, you know, and I think that, you know, whereas today, like, right, we go very extreme in the other direction.
Yeah, we do.
Right? I mean, the fact that it could hurt children, and in fact, we may have studies that it does hurt children, is not my problem as long as I'm allowed to consume them.
Right, right, right. No, I think that's exactly right. That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that, but I think you're totally right about that. You know, also, I think that anybody who thinks about it for a second knows that what you feed your head can hurt you or help you. That's not... That's not a difficult concept to grasp, I think.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's interesting. You know, it was actually very interesting because I just did a talk a couple months ago, you know, and there's this woman, and it was very interesting because she, you know, came, the first thing she said was that she's like, I'm against all censorship. Uh-huh. I'm completely against censorship. Well, first of all, I don't think anyone is completely. I mean, there's a few people, but we all agree that some censorship, right?
Yeah, we do. No question.
Very few people are okay with child pornography,
yeah,
right? Very few people are okay with snuff films. You know, there's a certain level that we all agree on. But, you know, but she comes out about this, right? And then it's interesting because she's also, you know, like a pacifist. And I'm kind of like, well, but you know, and we all know that, like, you know, the U.S. military uses, right, these kinds of video games and these sensory experiences to help train soldiers, right? These are tools that are well known to be used to help desensitize, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, we're giving them to average children.
Right.
And so, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, what are we doing and are we choosing to do it?
I don't know.
And I think in the 1950s, we just, we're maybe in some ways more open to asking that question, right? I mean, it's. I think, you know, people, I think, have a tendency to condemn the 50s as this very closed-minded time. But in a lot of ways, it wasn't. There was actually a lot of different arts and materials and things happening. But I think that people were more willing to question, you know, is this good? Is this good for society?
Yeah,
is this going
to
produce the kind of people that we want to produce?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that idea of children as a national project was something that was much more part of the culture at that time.
Yeah.
And I think when we look at a situation like this, it's important to keep that in mind instead of just seeing it as this, like, kind of repressive, you know, like this sexually repressive censorship, like, oh, they want to take away kids' fun reading materials.
Right.
Well, that's not, no. They really just wanted to say, is this going to create the kind of person in society that we want? And what does that mean? And how do we, as a national project, make that happen?
Yeah, I used to go to the drugstore and I would buy comic books. Sergeant Rock was my favorite. It was very violent, I have to say. The Americans always won. You know, they were gritty and tough and sacrificed for the nation. But like, as I say, I take my kids to the comic book store, Modern Marvels, down the street from where I live, next to the Ann Taylor, and there's all kinds of X-rated material in there. Just every imaginable thing. There's also Sergeant Rock, by the way, and Dungeons and Dragons and everything else. But there's also, I mean, I can't even mention it on the podcast. It's just disgusting what's in there. You know, I suppose that's where we've come to. You know, that all that stuff has to be mixed
up. Well, but it's also a little bit different today because today these things are considered appropriate. You know, there's an adult audience, right? I buy graphic novels.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I actually love graphic novels. I buy them. You know, I mean, most of my friends read all sorts of, you know, graphic novels, comic books, whatever. It's, you know, there's an adult audience. And so you can justify and say, this X-rated comic book is obviously not meant for a child. It's meant for an adult audience.
Right.
But it was much harder in 1954 when your entire audience was children. And, you know, the advertisements in the back of the magazine, really back you up on that. Because it's like when you have, like, toy guns and toy, you know, whips and all sorts of weird stuff, that no adult's going to order. It's really hard to say, but well, this is really meant for an adult. Well, no, right. There's no adults buying it. You're not marketing it to adults, and you have children's toys in the advertisement.
Right.
So I'm pretty sure this is for kids. And that was the point, is yeah. like, you know, if they had tried to cultivate an adult audience, right, then it would have been completely different. They could have, then I don't think censorship would have happened. If they had been able to say, these are not for children, no one's supposed to be selling these to children, right, these are supposed to be for adults. And
right.
in fact, that's what the law says. The law doesn't, you know, the law really is coming down and saying most of the law is about people under the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to decimate the industry because the industry did not want to put in the money to create the kind of art and graphics and whatever and storylines, frankly, that were sophisticated enough for an adult audience.
Mm-hmm.
So adults simply weren't buying them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what's going to decimate them is their own failure to create a market in the with adults, right, rather than, you know, they chose to simply market to children, and then ultimately they're going to pay the price for that when parents are like, I don't want my kids reading
right,
this.
Right, right, right. That's a good point. Well, Mariah, thank you very much for being on the show. Today we've been talking to Mariah Aden about her book, The Brooklyn Thrill Kill Gang and the Great Comic Book Scare of the 1950s. It's a fantastic book. I think you should go out and buy it and read it. You will not be disappointed. Thank you, Mariah.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And let me say thank you to everyone who downloads this podcast and listens to it. My name is Marshall Poe, and I'm the sometimes host of New Books in History, and I hope everybody has a great week.